Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Spillish After Show podcast. I am Brian Dunn. And no, don't say it, Robert, because you're a guest. That's right. I am flying solo. I'm going to be interviewing Robert because we just wrapped up Spillers number 7, and Robert spilled himself tonight. Didn't you, Robert?
I did. I even managed to get the word spill into the story.
You did get the word spill. You've always loved spill, spillers, spilled, any sort of variant of that.
I can't hear that word ever now without thinking of spiller. So it made its way into the story naturally, but yeah. I was happy to see it there.
No surprise there. So yeah, so you read, it had been a while. I know we both read at Spillers number 1. Here it is, Spillers number 7, and now you're reading again. How was the experience different? What did you enjoy about it?
Huh. Wow, is it different?
You're a different writer now.
I am very much a different writer now. Yeah. At Spillers number 1, neither of us knew what Spillers was going to be.
That's for sure.
We certainly didn't expect the gigantic crowd we had at the Crescent Ballroom that night.
Yeah.
In the tiny lounge in the front there. Standing room only crowd of about 80 people. They said capacity was 50. We didn't expect that. I was very new to fiction.
Mm-hmm.
To writing fiction. This was in August of 2015. I think I had written that piece probably just a couple months before that.
Okay. Was that part of a novel at the time, or was that a standalone?
It was. It still is part of a novel.
It still is,
yeah,
right?
It's been rewritten about 75 times since then.
Yeah.
Because the thing that's different between then and now is that it's been a couple of years. We have now spent a tremendous amount of time picking really great stories from fiction writers all around Arizona,
mm-hmm.
and talking to them on this podcast.
Yeah.
And what I can safely say is that I feel like I've been through some kind of graduate experience here where I have learned so much about writing by talking to people who do it extremely well and by listening to their stories and thinking about their stories and editing those stories.
Yeah.
I've learned so much about it that it has dramatically shaped the way that I write. And I can safely say also that probably some of the biggest influences to my writing now are people who have been on our stage.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic because, you know, they're getting something out of it. Obviously, we're putting them on stage and you know, we're putting them in the book and on the podcast, but we're also getting something out of it as well. And it's improving our own writing. And you just said it's influenced you more than anything.
I'm getting a literary education from this experience. So.
Yeah.
It was certainly not my intention when we started Spillers. I don't think I could have foreseen that happening, but
damned if it didn't. It happened anyway, didn't it?
Yeah. We've had some great writers and I have paid attention. I've been listening.
Yeah. Wow, I'm glad to hear that you have. Dare I suggest that's what you should have been
Welcome
doing.
Welcome to Spillers. I've been listening.
Well, I'm happy to hear that. So you said you had just kind of started writing fiction, but you've written a lot of nonfiction. You've published books. You're a writer of 9 nonfiction books.
That is true. I've written just a truckload of nonfiction in my life.
Yeah.
Most of it in the tech or design sectors. It's all been professional writing. Not that I've done manuals or anything like that.
No, that's very technical writing.
Yeah,
that's like the old school. Yeah.
Yeah, nothing like that.
Thank God.
I've written books on web design topics, user experience topics, which is was my profession for a really long time. So
yeah,
all of the books revolved around those topics, except for one, which is one that I published with a publisher in Austin last year. It's called The Build. It's actually was based on a hobby of mine, and it's about custom motorcycle design. And I actually pooled together several of my favorite motorcycle builders,
mm-hmm.
and picked their brains for hours on end about how they approach motorcycle design. And so I ended up doing a book about that.
Yeah.
So that I got to break very far out of the computer world and into something very different and still apply some of that design knowledge. But fiction is absolutely, I think, where my passion is. Not to say that I would quit writing nonfiction tomorrow, because there will always be nonfiction topics that interest me, but
right.
But fiction is where my heart is at. Nothing knocks me over like a great piece of fiction writing, and nothing makes me happier than to be able to produce one.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So let's talk about the Build real quick, though, because that was an Amazon best-selling in its category kind of a book, right? I mean, that was a...
It is. Depending on the day of the week, it sometimes still is.
That's very cool.
For the first, in the particular category that it was placed in on Amazon, it kind of juggled between the number one, number two, and number three slots for about, I think it was probably 6 months or so.
That's a pretty good juggle.
Yeah.
Right there.
So, yeah. I don't know, probably 80% of the time it was number one in that slot. And then when it wasn't, it was still number two or number three. And then it would jump back up the next day. I've been really, really, really proud of that fact and really just thrilled with how the publisher has gone to work promoting that. Earned me a lot of good press. I got to, you know, get some pieces into some really good publications because of that.
Now, didn't you also tell me that it was being used as a set piece on the television show Portlandia?
I'm so glad you remembered that.
I totally remember that. Yeah. I thought that was fantastic when I heard that.
Yeah. I was just ranting to my fiance Jody last night about how I've watched every episode of Portlandia so far this season.
Yeah. Looking for it, right?
Looking for it. And I haven't seen it yet. It hasn't popped up yet. I'm up through, I think, episode like 10, 9 or 10. Okay. And it hasn't shown up yet. But yeah, last year I had to like sign a release saying, yeah, it's okay if you use my book, The Build, as a set piece on the set of Portlandia. Like that didn't just make my week.
I was going to say, why would you not sign off on that?
Please do whatever you want with it.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm in. I'm only assuming that it's going to have something to do with the character Lance, who is the motorcycle junkie on the show.
Yeah, you would think so.
Yeah.
Has there ever been a situation where you thought you had spotted it and you were like, oh, let me freeze it here. Oh, no,
there are spots where Lance is standing in his garage where I've like paused right there and looked around the garage.
Sure.
To see if it's like sitting there and just, you know, not pronounced or what have you, but yeah, I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, well,
fingers
crossed that you do. So that's very cool. So you have The Build, which kind of, like you said, got you away from some of the tech stuff, the user experience stuff. Now you've got fiction going full bore. You're working on a novel, is that right?
I am.
Yeah, and you're pretty close to kind of wrapping it up, right? I mean, you and I have talked about it a little bit, and you have a last line. And a lot of times you talk about short stories building toward a last line and how satisfying it is when that last line really hits home and puts into context everything that came before it. But it sounds like you're kind of doing that same thing, but with a novel, which I'd imagine that's a much longer haul to get to that line. So how's that going?
You know, it's quite the trick I have learned. When I see it in short stories, I'm like effusive about it when I see it in short stories. Those are the stories I think that glue themselves into my brain more than any other story.
Yeah.
Is when something becomes incredibly clear on that last line, or almost even in the last word on occasion.
Even better.
Where, you know, you're following along with the story and you're in it. And you know it's going somewhere, but you don't yet really know where. And that last sentence suddenly makes something about the story that had been brewing. It suddenly, you know, just brings it to a boil and makes it perfectly clear, and just it glues itself into your memory. And some of the best reading, like novel reading experiences, I think, that I've had have culminated in the same way.
Yeah.
And so I really, really love it when people can do that, when writers can do that. And I think as I started writing this novel, I started to, see some recurring elements pop up, and I realized that one of those recurring elements was starting to shape itself into a metaphor for the whole thing.
Oh,
well, not even necessarily metaphor, but just like the point where it was becoming the point where it needed to end. And then I thought, and then I sort of backtracked and thought about the ways that I can drip that in to prepare the reader for when that happens.
For when you spring it on them.
For about 6 months now, I've had the last line of my novel in my head. I know where it's going.
Yeah.
I just have to fill in the gaps that get it there. And I'm probably 70 or 80% of the way there, I would say. There are sections I have yet to write, but there are sections that are all going to point to that.
Now, have you ever thought about actually like writing the line down and maybe like pasting it on the wall? Or... I don't know. Is there any concern about, you know, like accidentally hitting your head one day and oh my God, I can't remember the last line of the novel. What was it building toward?
it's burned into my brain, I can assure you, but
I'm sure it is, but I have
written it down somewhere.
Okay, good, good. Should anything happen to me, these are my papers. Yeah. It has the last
Feel
line
free to have a ghostwriter write those extra scenes that get there, but this is the last line.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I've actually written the closing segment.
Okay, all right.
Of the book, so, well, so good. There's that. But in the meantime, I've been really busy with work and working on nonfiction stuff and helping other people edit their books and things like that for the past few months. So I haven't actually done a whole lot novel writing lately.
Yeah.
But I'm feeling very motivated right now.
And
very much want to dive back into it. And also I think my style has developed, my writing style, my writing voice has developed so much in the past couple of years that I think writing the novel has actually helped me get there, because there are pieces of that have led to the style that I'm now latching on to.
Yeah.
But now I'm starting to write everything consistently in this voice.
See, yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I noticed you wrote the foreword for, or the about Spillers number 7 for this particular event book. And I noticed the writing style you were utilizing, and the way I think of it is, you know, there's a lot of momentum, a lot of like motion and movement and rhythm to it. And I've also noticed that in your Downtown Diaries.
Oh, yeah.
Do I have that right? Downtown Diaries, which is a column that you're writing for Downtown Phoenix Journal, because you write for them on a regular basis. And I noticed that same sort of style. And it's also in your fiction. It's in the short story that you read tonight. Mm-hmm. So I think you're achieving that consistent voice. The style that you're latching onto is coming through in all the different things that you're writing.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. When I decided to start working on the Downtown Diaries series for Downtown Phoenix Journal, I honestly just wanted to see if I could work that into nonfiction writing.
And
Downtown Diaries is... it's a series of articles in which I basically just tell like the autobiographical perspective of like moving to the core of Phoenix and the experiences of doing that, like grappling with like where do you live and where do you park and how do you deal with dogs and what is your life like now that everything is outside but you don't really have any neighbors and and what that's really like, because Downtown Phoenix Journal's part of their mission is to sort of get people to move downtown.
Yeah, you said that's very much the mission of the publisher, is she wants people to do that, and
I'm a good test case for that, because I didn't live that far from downtown in the first place. It was only a couple miles, but moving into the very city core, pretty much in the center of everything now, a lot of things about my life changed as a result of that. And so I'm writing this kind of memoir style pieces about that experience, but then also just kind of loading up facts that are relevant to that in a sidebar, so that it's good for like if you want takeaways about what it's like to move to the center of Phoenix, those facts are there and there's useful information and links and references and resources to go to and things like that. But I'm just starting the autobiographical stories. And so that was a way for me to figure out if I could work that voice into nonfiction and just start to carry it into everything
absolutely.
That I'm doing.
Yeah. So do you recommend that more people move to downtown Phoenix, Robert? can you be sort of an ambassador for that?
Wherever you live. You know what? I think I don't know if I'm an ambassador for, I don't know if I'd advocate for everyone wanting to do it. Like, I personally really like where Phoenix is at right now.
Yeah.
To me, it's like, it's an up and comer.
Agreed.
It's an up and coming city where there's, you know, we have great places like Valley Bar and Crescent Ballroom, and we have, really great restaurants popping up like all over the place. I mean, the Phoenix food scene, restaurant scene is becoming world renowned at this point.
That's true. It is.
But we still have statistically the lightest traffic. It's like
the
bottom five car traffic.
Really?
Yeah, the lightest traffic of pretty much any major city in the United States.
And
so we're an up and coming city in a lot of ways, and there are a lot of really great things happening here. But it's also a sleeper of enough of a town that you can still get around. There's still room to walk on the sidewalks. You can still get to places in a few minutes and not have to spend 3 hours trying to drive 3 miles.
Yeah. God, I hope it's never like that. I hope it's never, you know, the LA gridlock traffic that that keeps you stuck in your car.
Yeah. I lived in Austin for a year and a half and it was like that. I think I moved to Austin like 5 years too late.
Oh shoot.
I'd wanted to move there all five of those years, but we moved there five years too late. And yeah, it just got to the point where like if you wanted to cross, we only lived a mile and a half south of downtown Austin.
Okay.
And in order to get from our house to downtown, anywhere near rush hour was just that was a major tribulation. So I'm glad that I really like where Phoenix is at right now. And I like that it's growing and I want to continue seeing it grow and I want to see all that happen, but I don't want it to become Austin.
No, just a better version of itself, I think. Yeah. So let's talk about the short story that you read here tonight, because you took sort of an interesting approach. You took what I would consider to be a creative chance, the way you approached it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's called The Ginger Man. And there's some very cool elements in there. And can you just kind of talk about what your thought process was and how you approached this thing?
Yeah. Oh, well, I'd had this idea dancing around my head for quite a while, actually, of about a writer who refuses to do anything to promote himself and who in turn, you know, who actually just kind of forces the world to come to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I coupled that with the idea that there's this bar in Austin called the Ginger Man, where I used to go during South by Southwest, where I always had this experience. I would either spend half my night texting people and trying to chase down friends that I wanted to meet up with at South by Southwest, or I could go to the Ginger Man and sit on the patio and just one by one watch them show up.
Sounds like a much better way to go about it.
It was a much better way to go about it. I didn't have to do anything except sit there and drink beer. So
perfect.
And people would invariably just show up. And I thought, this is how the world should work. If you just sit in one spot long enough, it will all come to you. And
that's
I thought, I want to write this story about this writer who does that. And it very quickly evolved in my head to be about Spillers. To be about the people who have read at Spillers before, because these are people who are really committed to writing fiction, regardless of what fame wraps around them or if fame wraps around them.
Yeah. It's not for the money that they're doing it.
Yeah. It's all about the art for them. And so the Ginger Man is about this character who vehemently refuses to do anything to promote himself. And he is not about anything but the art, and that's it. And the world hates that.
Yeah. Well, I think the world probably can't comprehend, like in this day and age, why would somebody not want to promote themselves?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm really sick of the idea that, you know, writers have to build up social media profiles and they have to do all this stuff to build up their platforms to become viable, you know, business cases for publishers.
I was gonna say stuff that publishers used to do.
Yeah.
For all writers.
The stuff that publishers used to do, they now often take themselves off the hook and put that hook onto writers.
Yeah.
And I dislike that idea. I hate the idea that, you know, that my favorite musicians all have Twitter accounts. I don't like seeing that, you know, somebody whose songwriting I've worshipped for a couple of decades, like having to promote the show she's doing in Timbuktu, Kansas, to try to drum up 20 people in a bar. And it like that, it makes me sad.
When you put it like that, it is sad.
Yeah. I think fiction writers should spend their lives devoted to improving on their craft. I think that's what makes viable novels is craft and writing a great damn book. And you shouldn't have to spend your life promoting yourself in order to get into that position where you can, because you're diluting your energy. And so The Ginger Man is really about that, and it's about the writers who have read on our stage about how they feel about it. And that's how I see them. Like, these are people who are committed and who I'm going to learn from and who will keep doing this until they're 90.
Mm-hmm.
Because they care about the art.
Yeah.
And so I had to kind of step it up a little bit in terms of actual performance. And I think it just made it all that much riskier for me.
I think it did too.
Because I wrote this story in which someone, you know, this character, it turns out he writes first drafts. And as soon as I got done writing it, I thought, well, wait, Well, wait.
Well, wait. And yeah.
And I'm just going to leave that hanging for a second because, well, wait. Should this be a first draft?
Hmm.
Should I like embody the character when I go to read it on stage? And right. The more I thought about that, I went and talked to Ed Kearns about it, actually.
Ed Kearns, yeah.
Yeah, we met up in a bar and we had drinks and I told him about the story. And he was like, oh, man, you have to go. You have to do it. You have to commit. Just commit.
To it. Yeah.
Go all in, man. And so I was really encouraged by that conversation. And it just kind of spiraled from there, honestly. Like, I mean, you had the suggestion of, you know, at one point in the story, the character, when he walks up on stage, he stands there with his fingers around the mic stand for a full minute.
For a full minute.
Says nothing. Just yeah. stands there in the glow of the red light. And you had suggested that I do that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh God, that's torture. Because do you know what a minute feels like on stage when you're saying nothing?
Yeah. With every eye on you.
It's horrible.
It's an eternity. Yeah.
Yeah. It is seriously forever. And so I chose as my walk on music a track called 1 Minute of Silence by Soundgarden. And it's literally, it's like a recording of like nothing happening in a bar. That's all that, like, there's no sound, there's nothing, nothing happens. And it turns out it's actually a cover of 2 Minutes of Silence by the Beatles.
It's a cover of 2 Minutes of Silence.
Yeah. So yeah. When I said on stage, the song's a cover, like, I was not kidding.
That is hilarious. Wow.
So that, you know, the idea was I wanted to dedicate the story to Spillers, to all of our past writers. And so I thought, you know, I could do that during the 1 minute of silence. But as soon as the 1 minute of silence is done, I need a red light.
Yeah.
Because the ginger man stands under a red light.
He does.
I need a red light and I need to wait until that 1 minute of silence is done before I start reading.
Right.
Which just, and nobody had read the story. You had read the story, but absolutely not even my fiance had read the story. Nobody
read
the story.
Wait a second.
You were the only person.
Are you serious? She hadn't.
On the planet who read the story prior to me reading it on stage tonight.
That is so cool.
And it was a first draft. It was completely unedited. I did nothing to it except write some notes on the margins.
Yep.
For the event book, we had to grapple with how we were going to do that.
Yeah, we did.
And so we ended up printing them at like a slightly reduced size. It's about 20% smaller than usual. Mm-hmm. And folding them in half and sticking them into the books as
just
inserts.
Loose sheets.
Yeah,
which so I think is just a brilliant idea.
They're actually just scans of my typed pages.
Yeah.
So yeah, there was a whole lot about this that was just really nerve-wracking, but but the more I was really connected to the story, and I felt like it was a good proper ode to the writers who have read it, Spillers, and I was like, this it has to be a performance piece, because yeah. Spillers is not just fiction, it's performance, it's live on stage, and I thought
right.
I have to push that.
Well, I think you definitely pushed it, and you definitely committed to it, and you know. It takes a lot of nerve to do a first draft of something and have the confidence in it to go up and deliver it as is. And I just think it came off great, man.
I hope so, because, man, first drafts, they're nerve-wracking. There are definitely things I would change in that story if I were to take an editing whack at it.
Well, I'm sure. I'm sure that there are. But aren't you glad that you kind of resisted that and just did it as is? You know,
I am. I've thought so many times in my writing career that... that there's something to deadlines, you know, where like, mm-hmm. if I don't have a deadline, if I'm free of deadlines, I will edit and re-edit and re-edit and re-edit. And I will, I will just go on spin cycle like for God knows how long,
yeah.
like I'll never actually finish a thing. It'll keep evolving with my writing style a few months later. But if I have a deadline, I put it out, it goes. And when it gets published and I read it later, I'm happier with it than I ever am when I'm stuck in that spin cycle.
Yeah.
And so in this case, I just called it, you know, like I typed the story in an hour and just, that was it. I was done. I'm never going to touch it again. It is exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I'm actually happier with how that story has turned out than I think I would be if I edited it three or four times.
Yeah. How cool is that, though, when that can be the case? You know, I think it's definitely a writerly tendency to rehash and rehash and change this word and change that word. But just to be able to produce something and say, you know what, this is what I produced. This is the way I produced it. And I like it as is. It stands on its own. I think that's great, man.
Yeah, it was scary as hell.
I bet it was scary.
To stand by it in that way. But, you know, I mean, I was really nervous about reading it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it felt good as I was reading it. I felt like I read it the way I wanted to read it. Mm-hmm. So I'm really happy with how that came out. And, I was really happy with the response from it, for sure.
Yeah, no, I think it was a great response. And I enjoyed watching you deliver that. Kudos to you, man.
Thank you.
That's a bold approach.
I realize I just probably answered a whole bunch of questions you didn't ask. But
and that's all we have time for.
Hookman out.
Yep. And that's going to do it. No, I think that pretty much sums it up. So unless there's anything else, we're going to call this one good, Robert.
Right on. Okay. We look forward to seeing you guys at Spillers 8. And
Spillers number 8.
Keep listening to this podcast because there are some good episodes coming up.
Definitely. Definitely. All right. Well, hey, man, thanks for doing Spillers with me tonight.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, man. We'll catch you later.